Today we continue our study into the book of Revelation. Mr. Newsman mentioned that he was going through it, and I felt I would just pick it up where he left off and go on from there. And last time we were in chapter 17, and we were given what will occur at the end of the age. A wealthy, powerful, spiritual harlot whose roots go back to Babylon will be riding a beast here at the final revival of the Roman Empire. Many kings and nations will be affected by her, and she will persecute God's servants. That's how she's done it all the time. And we know that 10 kings will join themselves to this beast, and they will fight Jesus Christ at his return. They're going to take him on. And as we saw that in Revelation 17. Now, that brings us to the judgment of Babylon, which is in Revelation chapter 18, which I hope to cover today. The judgment of Babylon falls in 6 parts, and we'll take them piece by piece. The first is the fall of Babylon, and that's in verses 1 to 3. And then comes the call to leave the city. A call to leave the city. And that's in verses 4 and 5. And then, in the next verses 6 to 8, there is judgment on the city. And then, a long section from 9 to 19 of lament over the city's fall. And then the destruction of the city, verses 20 to 24. And the last part isn't in chapter 18, it's in chapter 19. And that is the first 5 verses of chapter 19. It's thanksgiving for the fall, for the judgment of Babylon. And we'll cover that as part of chapter 19. At least that's my plan for today, just to cover that. So the fall of Babylon, verses 1 to 3, a call to leave the city, verses 4 to 5, judgment on the city, verses 6 to 8, lament over the city's fall, verses 9 to 19, the destruction of the city, verses 20 to 24, and thanksgiving for the judgment of Babylon, chapter 19, verses 1 to 5. And, of course, that section is followed by the marriage of the Lamb, chapter 19, verses 6 to 10. I think you'll enjoy that section. This section today is a very sobering section of chapter 18. We've had, I get all the sobering, chapter 16 is very sobering, chapter 17 sobering, and chapter 18 sobering, and then we start getting to the happier ones a little further along. But we're into the sobering section. The Tyndale New Testament commentary makes this comment about chapter 18. In vivid and unforgettable language, John outlines the judgment of the great city. He describes her fall and its effect on those who were in sympathy with her. There are many coincidences of language with the description of the fall of Tyre in Ezekiel 26 to 28. And that of Babylon, Isaiah 3, 14, 21, those chapters, 13, 14, and 21, and Jeremiah 50 and 51. Jeremiah 50 and 51 are 2 long chapters, and I plan to read you just the conclusion of it here today, 2 long chapters of God talking about what he's going to do to Babylon and prophecies about Babylon. I'll read you the conclusion of it. I won't read you the whole 50 to 51. Continuing the Tyndale New Testament commentary, he, John, is catching up all that the prophets have said as announced the doom of Tyre or Babylon or Nineveh. And that's exactly true. These prophecies were there, these various cities, but they all culminate in this final resurrection. Continuing in the Tyndale commentary, but he is thinking not of the fall of one city or empire, but of the collapse of civilization. Remember Jesus said, it's going to fall, and when it does, great will be the fall of it. That's the same thing he's talking about. But he is thinking not of the fall of one city or empire, but of the collapse of civilization. Final judgment means the overthrow of all that opposes itself to God, and that is correct. Remember, keep in mind, Daniel, when the dream that Nebuchadnezzar saw, it started with Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and it went all the way down through the Roman Empire, and it was on the feet of that the whole system collapsed when it was struck by that rock. So that whole system that was there from that time, all the way down through, is going to disappear. And it says when it's gone, there's not a trace of it left. We're talking about that fall of Babylon here today. So we're going to cover that. So let's begin Revelation 18. And that first section, the fall of Babylon, Revelation 18, verses 1 to 3. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. The whole earth was illuminated by it. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. What I normally do, as I hope you know it now, is I go through the section and I go back and take it apart and analyze it. It says, another angel coming down from heaven. So John is now viewing these things from the earth. He sees an angel coming down from heaven to the earth, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. This angel has incredible authority. It's not typical that the whole earth is illuminated by an angel. And this is a very powerful angel. As mentioned, his glory fills the earth. I mean, that's remarkable. And he cried mightily with a loud voice. The Greek loud voice suggests an exceptionally strong voice. It's to carry out with a very loud voice. If you keep your finger there, and we'll go back and have a look at Ezekiel chapter 43. Ezekiel chapter 43. As the Tyndale and other commentaries noted, these all hearken back to prophecies of the Old Testament. Ezekiel 43. And verse 1. Afterward, he brought me out to the gate that faces toward the east. Apparently, he's in the temple here, and the gate toward the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. This is picturing, the east gate of the temple has been permanently closed because it's thought that would be the one the Messiah would come through. And we'll see how that all works out, but this is the same picture, and it's why they think that. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. His voice was like the sound of mighty waters, and the earth shone with his glory. Now, that's the same thing we were reading there. A mighty, powerful voice. Remember when God spoke from Mount Sinai, the people said, you talk to us, Moses. So he spoke with the sound of mighty waters. Have you ever been by mighty waters? I mean, really mighty. You can't talk to the person next to you. They're so loud. We've been to Victoria Falls, and maybe you've been to Niagara Falls, and they have a little boat that goes right up to the front of Niagara Falls, and you're shouting to somebody standing next to you. It's very powerful. The sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. It was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I, when I came, or Margin says, when he came to destroy the city. The visions were like the visions which I saw in the river Kibar, and I fell on my face. The voice was so strong, and the light was so strong that he fell on his face. This seems to be a very similar thing. In Exodus, God is referred to as the angel of the Lord. If you look at Exodus 3, it talks about the angel of the Lord came to the bush. And then it says, and the Lord said from the bush. So it talks about the Lord being there. So this angel that came down here in Revelation 18, is a mighty, powerful angel, and maybe more than that. This angel said, Babylon the Great is fallen. This powerful angel declares the end of Babylon. If you go back to Genesis chapter 11, Genesis the 11th chapter, we'll get the beginning of this system just to see it, and so we have a good background. He's saying here, Babylon is fallen. Genesis chapter 11, you probably remember, this is the chapter where they wanted to build a tower because they didn't want to scatter over the earth. They wanted to all stay together, all around the good, you know, catering shops and chemists and all around the nice clothing stores and all the good stuff there in Babylon. They wanted to stay right there. They didn't want to go away. So God did something. Genesis chapter 11, verse 7. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they might not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad. They didn't want to scatter, so God scattered them. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the languages of the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. The name Babel goes back to here. And, of course, he scattered them out and got the confusion and so on, because the languages were all changed. But Babylon is symbolic of all the attempts of mankind to govern themselves apart from God. These people wanted to build this tower in defiance of what God said and do their own way. God said, we're going to change that. What he did was he popped out the cassette and put in another one. Now, I don't know how he did that. But it's just like you push the eject button, take out whatever language it was and put in all these other languages. And he can do that. He said he's going to change this back to a pure language, and of course that'll be, I have no idea what that'll be. if it's going to be a pure language, it's going to be hard to see how it'll be English. but then it's probably hard to see how it'll be any language, so he'll have to work that one out. Okay, now, so Babylon is symbolic of all man's attempts to govern themselves apart from God. And the term Babylon is fallen, the double falls, is first used in Isaiah 21. Isaiah uses that same expression. I was taught that the repetition is pointing to the final fall. It's fallen, done. That the double meaning there is there. Here, it's Babylon the Great is fallen. Presumably the chief apex of Babylon, when it's at its highest power that it'll ever be, and that's when it falls. Babylon the Great is fallen. Ancient Babylon seemed impregnable. It seemed impossible for anybody to take ancient Babylon, and yet it fell very easily in 539 B.C., so the future Babylon that John will be shown will seem impregnable and that nobody can take it on. But it too will fall, never to rise again. Following on in chapter 18, there are three headings. It has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated birds. Such birds live in uninhabited places. And that's the emphasis here. If you look at Isaiah chapter 13, the whole chapter's about Babylon. We'll pick out certain points of it. Isaiah 13 and verse 1. The burden against Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw. And this is, he goes down into the whole of chapter 13. But let us skip down to verses 6. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. You know, the expression, the day of the Lord, means the day that God intervenes in the earth. The day of the Lord. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will be limp. Every man's heart will melt. And they will be afraid. Pangs of sorrow will take hold of them, and they will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames. It will be so startling when God actually does this. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He will destroy its sinners from it, for the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. the heavenly signs, a powerful intervention by God. And I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for its iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud. You know, we humans on the earth are so proud. We are so lifted up as a group. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. And he goes on, let's skip down to verse 19. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And you know what he did there? He just wiped them off the map. It will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pinch his tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But the wild beasts of the devil will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls. What were formerly houses now will be disinhabited by animals. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, and jackals in their pleasant places. Her time is near to come, and her days will not be prolonged. You ever seen a hyena? When we lived in Africa, we saw a number of them, and they're just not very handsome. And they're pretty unpleasant sort of animals. This is also mentioned in Jeremiah 51:37. I won't go there. So then we start talking about Babylon's corruption. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Now, we covered that statement in Revelation 14:8 and went through the details of it there. But the Babylonian system is the major source of deception on the earth today. It's the cause of so much difficulty because people don't know the truth. You know, one of the blessings is being taught the truth. And Babylon hides the truth and has all kinds of things that cause people to be like they're drunk, that they can't see straight, and they can't act properly, and they can't reason right, because they've been deceived. It's not their fault, in a sense, because they've been totally deceived. As we've noted, we've understand Babylon in two ways. As the capital city of the beast, we talked about that, and also the whole worldwide deceived society set up in defiance to God. The whole thing is Babylon. So it's a very big. And as I mentioned before, and I'll mention again, in the book of Daniel, Babylon began with Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And then it was taken over by other people, but it was the same system. And it kept rolling down until Christ's return. But it's the same system. It's important to keep that in mind. And her deceitful, lying ways bring on God's wrath. God's very merciful. He hasn't dealt with this, but when he does, he's going to deal with it very firmly. It says, the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So he's talking about the political leaders, the kings, have been intimately involved in Babylon. They participate in the system. And the merchants of the earth grow rich from her excessive luxuries. Business is good. It goes very well. So nations, kings, and merchants are pictured as being, if you don't mind, in bed with Babylon. The last word, excessive luxuries, implies self-indulgence and arrogance. It's more than just luxuries. It's just so much and so abundant that it just gets into all kinds of wickedness. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, see note on 1 Timothy 5:11 where the Greek verb wax wanton, they will wax wanton, is akin to the noun here, translate wanton luxury. The reference is not to earthly merchandise, but to spiritual wares, indulgences, idolatries, and superstitions, worldly compromises wherewith the harlot, that is the apostate church, has made merchandise of men. They understood something there at that time. So this abundance is just there. It says, the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So that's the judgment of Babylon. God says it's going to fall. And that's the announcement. And this is done by a strong angel, very powerful angel, and who has the wherewithal to bring it about. Now, verses 4 and 5. Here's a call to God's people. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive her plagues, for her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquity. Now picture this. Here's Babylon getting strong and powerful, and God's people despised Sabbath keeping, holy day keeping, unleavened bread keeping, refusing to bow down to the idols, and refusing to compromise with God's truth. They'll be under pressure and may be tempted to participate in this corrupt and evil system, but it still has a certain attraction. Because if they cooperate, persecution ceases. Hey, you're accepted by the world. And then wealth is available. You can buy and sell. You can participate. You can get in there, build up a pension fund, and work to be able to have certain wealth and be accepted as part of a society. There are so many warnings in Scripture. Abraham was told to leave. His first instruction that we know about Abraham is he's told to move out. Lot was told to leave Sodom, and his wife didn't want to. She looked back longingly for all the little boutiques that were there, or whatever, you know, whatever was at the was the draw in Sodom. Israel was told to come out of Egypt, and they had to leave. Later, Israel was told, leave the tents of Dathan and Abiram, because they had gotten way out of line. They gotten really proud and haughty, and he says, leave the tents, back away from them. Those who listened, listened. There are many warnings in the prophets. I'll just enumerate where it says, come out of her, my people, and not in exactly the same words, but in virtually the same words. It appears in Isaiah 48:20. Isaiah 48:20, Isaiah 52:11, in Jeremiah 50:8, 51:6, 51:6, and 51:45, Jeremiah 51:45, and also in Zechariah 2:6-7. And let me show it to you in another place. In the New Testament, this is even in the New Testament. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Paul, as you remember, wrote a very strong letter to the Corinthians, which we know was the 1 Corinthians. Here in the second one, he's kind of encouraging him, but he's also continuing the teaching and encouraging him to keep up with it. So he says in chapter 6 and verse 14, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Now remember last week I covered this thing about if you're going to be with the sinful, you're going to go clear out of the world. But he's talking about people who are brethren. Here he's talking about getting yoked. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? Now, we're talking about fellowship and with people in different positions. I find I mostly socialize, not fellowship. Fellowship is a spiritual connection. And there's a distinction there between fellowshipping and with people have a different view. I've noticed we've been separate now. Down in Chicago, we enjoyed relatively goodwill with members of the Worldwide Church of God. But we find as the time goes on, we don't have as much in common, and we're not seeing. It's going, there's just a difference there. It's just happening. And that's what happens long term when people are going different directions. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? Can you mix light and darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? A believer and an unbeliever are two different groups there. And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? He's trying to help the Corinthians see, wait a minute, you can't have it both ways. You can't be in the world and in the church. Now we're in the world, but we're not of the world. There's a big difference. And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. In other words, he'd be in there communing with the people. I will walk among them. And then verse 17 of 2 Corinthians 6, therefore, since he's to be among us, come out from among them, the world, and be separate, says the Lord, and do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. It doesn't stop there. It goes over the next verse, verse 1 of chapter 7. Therefore, having these promises, the promise that God would dwell among us, that we will be his children and he will be our father. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of the Lord. We're going through on our small group Bible study, 1 Peter, and Peter's emphasis is on being holy. And Paul's is on the same thing. And we have to make certain changes there. So God says to his people, come out of her, my people. And that's the same message. It's the same one. If you look at 1 John, and this is one you know well, I believe you know well, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. 1 John chapter 2. All these servants of God are trying to point us in the same direction. 1 John chapter 12, chapter 2, not 12, and verse 15. Do not love the world or the things that are in the world. Now, there's some nice people out there, and we care for them deeply. But we don't love the society the way it works. It's very hard to see right now with our presidential election and everybody jumping in and saying, I'm the guy, or I'm the gal. You just think, this is, and people posturing to put themselves up in all this. And this is the best system on the face of the earth. I'd rather live under this one than any other one. I've lived under different ones. This is the best. Now there's some that are pretty close and very similar. All the Western countries of, especially the English-speaking countries, they're very similar. Not identical. South Africa once, because there were sanctions on the country, they said, can't buy fuel from 6 p.m. on Friday night to 6 a.m. Sunday morning. And I'm thinking, you can't say that. My American genes coming out. You can't say that. Oh, yes, they can. And in Britain, you remember we had radio stations there. You can't go on the British Broadcasting as a religious program unless the Church of England says you're okay. And for some reason, they didn't seem to like us. Now, we have freedoms. We can go on and say anything. You can't do that everywhere. Not even in Britain. We want to be grateful for what we got. We got problems, but we want to be grateful for what we've got. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, if somebody loves this society, and we show that by how we, by our choices, if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. If God's love is in there, then you can see that this isn't God's way. This isn't built on love. The love of the Father is not in him. Notice how categorical John is. Boom. Love of the Father is not in him. Boom. We're very slow to be that direct. But of course, he's trying to help us to see. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, that's what's in the world, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, the pride that we're alive so we're important, and we're smart, and we're chic, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away. Now, if you believe the gospel, then you have to believe the world is passing away. It's part of the message. And the lust of it. This society is built on wanting. And it's going to be passed away. The society that's coming is going to be built on loving. And it's totally opposite. And the world is passing away and the lust of it. But he who does the will of the Father abides forever. So this is the same call. Come out of her, my people. For Christians, compromising with Satan's system is fatal. As I mentioned, we live in the world. We certainly do. But we must not be of the world. That must be totally different. If you look at Matthew chapter 16, Matthew chapter 16, and verse 24, Matthew 16, 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, now, it's always interesting to note to whom he's speaking. Sometimes he's talking to the world, sometimes he's talking to the disciples, sometimes he's talking to both. Here, it says he's talking to his disciples, which kind of means teaching for those who are listening. If anyone desires to come after me, to follow Christ, to walk in his ways, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Mr. Schultz was talking about how we fight with ourselves. That's what it's talking about. We take that cross, as it were, and we say this self is not going to do what it wants. It's going to do what God wants. And there's a big difference in those. If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. We have to see that our life that's now is not the key thing. Whoever desires to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world? Suppose you win not only the lottery, but all the lotteries, and you own the whole world, and loses his own soul. He doesn't live. Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward, and the word is reward, each one according to his works. There are gifts, there are inheritances, and here's talking about rewards. So they're all different things. I won't go into all that, but according to their works. He followed me, and he put that old self down, saw to it, it was dead. Okay, so the voice from heaven says, my people, whoever are my people, come out of her, my people. In a sense, it's not to those who aren't his people. Now, everyone has the opportunity to be his people, but it has to be a choice. And it has to be by a response. My people. The voice from heaven may be God's, but there are reasons to believe that it may not be that directly. The voice of an angel, we'll see how it all goes. He said, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. If we get involved with the world and we start sinning like the world does, then we get the plagues the world's going to get for doing that. Plagues can include sickness and disease, of course, but most of all, plagues point to receiving God's wrath at the end of the age. That's the main one, which will be poured out on Babylon as described in the next verses. Now let's go to verses 6 to 8. Verses 6 to 8. A call for judgment to come on the city. Render to her just as she rendered to you. I've mentioned before the principle of just recompense. Or the legal term today is lex talionis. Equal retribution or equal punishment. Render to her just as she rendered to you. Repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix her double. In the measure that she has glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. Therefore her plagues will come in one day. Death and mourning and famine, she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. Very strong language, as I'm sure you'll agree. In the cup which she has mixed, mixed double for her. Babylon has caused so much harm, and the cup she's made everybody drink, in many cases forcing it on them, that God doubles his response. God is love, but he's also to be feared. And his love includes removing those who deceive and lie and harm. That's part of his love. His love includes removing a deceiving and lying harlot from the earth. She says in her heart, she might not say that outwardly, because that would be self-pride. So there's a humble exterior. But she says in her heart, I sit as queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. Brethren, I'm sure you'll agree that God sees corruption that we don't see. and that he sees it all. And we tend to want to give the benefit of the doubt, and that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. But he sees everything clearly. She thinks she's secure, but she's not. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 47. Isaiah chapter 47. And once again, these are the same prophecies. God's servant, through God's servant Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, they're all in there. Isaiah 47 and verse 1. My Bible has a heading over the chapter, The Humiliation of Babylon. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne. Not sitting all exalted above everybody now, sitting on the ground. Quite a come down. O daughter, sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. The image is tender and delicate. The reality is quite different. Take the millstone, grind meal, remove the veil, take off the skirt, uncover the thigh, pass over the rivers. Your nakedness shall be uncovered. Yes, your shame will be seen. We don't see it, but we will. Everybody will. How corrupt this really is. Your nakedness shall be uncovered, and your shame will be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will not arbitrate with a man. There's no negotiation here. This is going to be the way it is. As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit in silence and go in darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called the Lady of Kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I have profaned my inheritance and given them into your hand. You showed them no mercy. On the elderly, you laid your yoke very heavily. You said, I sit as a lady forever. She's laying a yoke on elderly, but I'm a lady. And you said, I shall be a lady forever, so that you did not take these things to heart, nor remember the latter end of them. Therefore, hear this now, you who are given to pleasures. There's an image of poverty, but there's really a lover of pleasure underneath. Who dwells securely, who say in your heart, I am, and there was no one else besides me. I'm sitting in the catbird seat. I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know the loss of children. But these two things will come upon you in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon you in their fullness. Because of the multitude of your sorceries, for the great abundance of your enchantments, sorceries, enchantments. For you have trusted in your wickedness, and you have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you, and you've said in your heart, I am, and there is no one else beside me. Therefore, evil shall come upon you, and you shall not know from where it arises. And trouble shall befall you, and you will not be able to put it off. And desolation shall come upon you suddenly, which you shall not know. She's not getting ready for this. She thinks she's in a good spot, and nothing can harm her. Back to Revelation 18. Therefore, her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord who judges her. Notice, God is strong. His power is supreme. He doesn't show it off a lot. Thousands of years in between. But nevertheless, his power is supreme. And he judges. He has considered and he has determined what should happen. And his judgment is not arbitrary. You know, brethren, God's judgment is not a popular concept today. People don't want to hear about God's judgment. They don't want to hear about it. And it's maybe a little heavy for you to hear about it, as strongly as I'm putting it. But this is what he says in the book. He says it exactly that way. God's judgment is not popular. People do everything to get away from it and to say it's not going to happen. But it's in the Bible very clearly. It's very plain. And we're in a section that makes it especially plain. Okay, let's go back now to Revelation 18. And we'll go to this long lament. I plan to read through the first short section, and then I'll read through a long section of it. It's a lament over Babylon's fall. Verses 9 and 10. The whole section is verses 9 to 19, but we're going to do the first section, verses 9 and 10. The kings of the earth, we saw them before, who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her, will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." Now, the kings of the earth, of course, are the political leaders who hold power in concert with this harlot. And they live luxuriously with her. You ever heard of Gotcha Buthelezi? He's the descendant of Shaka, the Zulu king. He's the current Zulu king, and he's been the leader of the Zulus since I lived in South Africa, and we arrived there in 1969, although I think he may have come in while I lived in South Africa. I lived there from 69 to 78. Actually met him once. But at any rate, he said something very, very, insightful. As I say, he's the leader of the Zulus now in South Africa. He said, "When the white man came to Africa, they had the Bible and we had the land. Now we have the Bible and they have the land." I thought that's a pretty insightful comment. I have a feeling this future Babylon will come with Bible, religious, and then end up with the land too, in the same way. JF&B, where these kings are lamenting Babylon's fall. JF&B, Jameson Fawcett Brown says, contrast the world's rejoicing over the dead bodies of the two witnesses in Revelation 11:10, who had tormented it by their faithfulness, and the lamentations over the harlot who made the way to heaven smooth and had been found a useful tool in keeping subjects in abject tyranny. Men's carnal mind relishes a religion like that of the apostate church, which gives an opiate to conscience while leaving the sinner license to indulge his lusts. Very strong statement. But correct. But correct. Men's carnal mind relishes a religion like that of the apostate church, which gives an opiate to conscience while leaving the sinner license to indulge his lust. Now, verses 11 to 18. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, and every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, marble, and cinnamon, and incense, and fragrant oils, and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and bodies and souls of men. The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things, who became rich by her, will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster and all that travel by ships, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What is like this great city?'" This is quite a graphic picture here. And we can expect those things to happen again. In fact, perhaps we're seeing the early stages of it now, a prosperity on the earth that it's never seen. I don't know if we realize we live in a unique society, of a global society with unique prosperity. People are keep waiting for things to fall down and get weak, and they're all sitting there, what's the stock market going to do and all that? Well, interesting, what's the housing market? You know, it says in Matthew 24, they're going to be eating and drinking and marrying till the day it happens. There'll be a prosperity, and everything's going fine, partying and everything else till the day it happens. Now, I don't know that every place is, because there are going to be famines in different places, and there are going to be other things, but most people aren't going to know. It's going to be prosperous. Whether it goes that way continually or not, I don't know. But like I say, we may be seeing early stages of it. The list begins with clothing and garments. Fine linen, purple, and scarlet. All expensive materials. Very expensive materials. Then precious metals such as gold and precious stones and pearls. And they're big. Most of us don't realize how big these industries are on the earth today. That it's huge. It's much bigger than the average person knows. On all these different things. Then comes every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble. Precious in all of them. Citron wood was a hard, fragrant, and beautifully marked wood, which was very popular with Roman cabinet makers. And so every kind of citron wood would imply that they have great varieties. So this variety, light, dark, medium, shades one way, shades another. It could be all kinds of things that was there. Next come agricultural products, cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat. Did you know in these days when the Bible was, New Testament was written, Rome's wheat came from Egypt. It was brought by ship from Egypt. Egypt used to be a pretty productive place. Now with desertification, it's not so good. Egypt has to bring in wheat. But it used to come in from Egypt, and they would have it there. And, of course, Egypt's changed a lot. Last come livestock, cattle and sheep and horses and chariots and bodies and souls of men. Well, I think we know about cattle and sheep, and we know the meat industry. Do we realize how big the meat industry is? That we go to all these shops, and it's all lined up with any cut you want. Think of all the shops and all the places and all the freezers and all the homes. How much, it's incredible, the industry that's in this country, but not just in this country. We tend not to see these things, especially us in the church. We don't, you know, we're not the super wealthy. We're not sitting in Wall Street. We're not, you know, we're seeing what's happening and knowing all these things. Notice it says the bodies and souls of men. Some commentators think that that's two ways to indicate slaves. But today we know that human corpses have value. I was with a family, with another minister from another congregation, another church. We happened to be in the same place, and this person was dying and wasn't quite dead. But they got to a point where they thought, not going to bring her back. And before she was gone, they were already asking the husband for permission to take the organs. They go quick. All very polite, all very caring. You'd like to share, wouldn't you? Hope you're never in that situation. So it seems the bodies mean cadavers, and souls mean people that are alive, the bodies and souls of men. And notice, the merchants don't decry the loss of the city itself. What they decry is the loss of income. Alas, alas. They don't care about the people in the city, apparently. It's our business model that's messed up. We can't do it. They're grieving about the loss of income potential. Like U.S. automakers too often, nobody's buying their stuff. You know, all of a sudden they're lamenting because of the situation. And God continues, the fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. That phrase, the things which are rich and splendid, mean the real luxuries of life, the luxury items, and they're never going to have them again. The merchants of these things, who became rich by her, will stand at a distance for fear of torment, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, that great city which was clothed with fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. It looked permanent and solid, and then it disappeared. The kings of the earth lamented over Babylon's loss of power. The merchants mourn for the loss of material riches. The next group is really interesting. Those who earn their living from the sea. also lament Babylon. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, who is like this great city? All who earn their living at sea is the NIV translation, and it's probably a much larger group than most of us have any idea of. We live here in the Midwest, and, you know, we see ships maybe in the lake, but in the ocean there are traveling huge super tankers. The shipping industry is so big that it's, I think most of us have no idea how much that goes on. It says that those who earn their living from the sea. Today, all shopkeepers sell imported goods. And if imported, they had to go by the sea, or by air in some cases. TVs, nobody carries TVs by air. They carry them by sea. Microwaves, computers, cars, toasters, shavers, you know, all kinds of things, clothing, goods from China, Taiwan, all the Asian countries where they manufacture over there, and it's shipping. And they go by the container load. And I happened to sit next to a plane. We're going down to Florida for the young adults activity, and sat next to a fellow of Asian, he's an Indian, and he tells me he used to be a captain on these ships, and now he's moved up. He has his little computer, and he drives them around and tells what to put on where, what to take it off, and where to stack it so the load is balanced. And he does this with all these different ships, and that's just one company. And he talks about the number of people have it. They can get a huge ship with a crew of 12. And you think, how can they do that? And these ships go in, and they're so big now, they talk about how they can get into Rotterdam, and they have to get them in there because they're so huge. But it's economical to carry a big thing. And there are thousands of them. There are thousands of them plying the seas at any one time with these huge ports. Long Beach is just one port in the U.S. And, of course, you got coasts on the East Coast and West Coast, and you got the ports of Hong Kong and Singapore and Rotterdam. Rotterdam's one of the busiest ports in the whole world. You know, God promised Israel gates, sea gates. He gave them land gates, too, sea lanes. And when you control the gates, it has military implications and also commercial implications. You have commerce. God knows that these sea lanes are important. We tend not to think strategically. But military and commercial strength lead to political power and wealth. They lead to the two together. One of the reasons our nation prospered. So the people who lost their livelihood from the sea become very emotional, and they continue to lament. They are devastated. Verse 19, they threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she's made desolate. It's such a big industry today that most of us can't comprehend it. Sometimes you'll see on the Travel Channel or the Learning Channel or the Discovery Channel these things about shipping and things along that. Have a look. You'll be astonished at what goes on. And air travel, too. Air freight is unbelievable. You know, one of the biggest air freight terminals in the world is up in Alaska? One example. French Beaujolais. It's a very popular drink around the world. So when it comes due, it's air freighted all over the world so everybody can drink it at once. It goes through Alaska, naturally. It's incredible what's going on. They fly horses back and forth. I mean, they do all kinds of things by air. You wouldn't believe. We have chili, papaya from Chile. How's it get here? By air. Huge things of it. And then they distribute it across the whole United States. It is amazing. There's so much more out there than most of us recognize. Okay, let's go on to the finality of Babylon's fall, verses 20 to 24. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. Some of the commentaries are critical of this statement, and they say, you shouldn't rejoice at destruction. God's people have a different view of Babylon. First of all, the apostles were killed by it, and the prophets were too. So he said, rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. Heaven looks down and see all that's going on here, and they're probably holding their heads saying, God, when are you going to stop this? Well, not just yet. God's people have a different view. Babylon is the system by which Satan has deceived the whole world. We know Christmas and Easter and all that sort of thing. instead of keeping unleavened bread and learning to put sin out and keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, learn about God's reign, where we start learning that. And Sunday, instead of God's Sabbath, of which Jesus is the Lord. He's the Lord of the Sabbath. They call the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath, Judaizing, revealing a certain anti-Semitism. The Synod of Laodicea, 4th century, canon 29. Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's day. And if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ. That's a curse on anyone that would keep the Sabbath. They teach mindless ritual instead of the truth of God and worshiping Him in spirit and truth. Babylon is the reason the whole world can't find the way to peace. Only God knows the way to peace. Babylon is the political power that has always worked against the servants of God. Always, always, always. When Jesus was a baby, they killed off a whole bunch of kids 2 years and under just to be sure in case they get him. And they've gone after his servants ever since. Look at Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6. This is the fifth seal. Revelation chapter 6. And verse 9. And when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they had. These are faithful martyrs of God. And he's picturing them like Abel's blood crying out to him from the ground. Remember he said that? Your brother's blood cries out to me, that God should avenge it. But he hasn't yet. I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried out with a loud voice, symbolically, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood upon those who dwell on the earth? When you're going to avenge us as you promised. Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. This is coming again. I don't know when, but it's coming again. God promised to avenge the death of his servants, and in Revelation 18, we hear that he does. Verses 21 to 24. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found any more. The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, trumpeters shall not be heard in you any more, nor craftsmen of any craft shall be found in you any more. And the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you any more. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you any more. And the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall not be heard in you any more. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived, and in her was found the blood of prophets and saints, and of all who were slain in the earth. All murder comes from not knowing the right way of God. It says, a mighty angel took up a stone, like a great millstone, and threw it into the sea. Let's go back to Jeremiah 51. Earlier I mentioned that Jeremiah 50 and 51 is a long prophecy against Babylon, those two long chapters. And he goes over it in great detail. Now let's pick it up in Jeremiah 51 verse 60. So Jeremiah wrote in a book all of the evil that would come upon Babylon. Jeremiah 51 verse 60. So Jeremiah wrote in a book all the evil that would come upon Babylon. All these words that are written against Babylon. 50 and 51. And Jeremiah said to Sarah, when you arrive at Babylon and see it, read all these words. Then you shall say, O Lord, you have spoken against this place to cut it off, so that none shall remain in it, neither man nor beast, but it shall be desolate forever. He still hasn't done that. That's still to happen. Now it shall be, when you have finished reading this book, that you shall tie a stone to it. You take the words he just read, you tie a stone to it, and throw it into the Euphrates. Then you shall say, Thus Babylon shall sink and not rise from catastrophe that I will bring upon her, and they shall be weary. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah. Very strong stuff. Have you ever seen a huge stone fall in the water? It goes down kaploosh, you know, and there's this huge sound. And then there's this great thing that comes back up again from it, and it, all this motion, and then all of a sudden, nothing. And that's how Babylon's going to fall, like a big stone falling in the water with a huge, whatever you call that thing, spout, lots of disturbance, and then the sea just, then it's gone. This is the same thing that's in Revelation, the very same thing. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for your sorceries, all nations, for by your sorceries, all nations were deceived. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints of all who were slain on the earth. Babylon has a lot to answer for. Has a lot to answer for. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Applied by Christ, he said the blood of Abel to Zechariah, not exactly all who were there, but he says, applied by Christ to apostate Jerusalem, which proves that not merely the literal city Rome or the Church of Rome, though the chief representative of the apostasy, but the whole of the faithless church of both Old and New Testament is meant by Babylon the harlot, just as the whole church, the Old and New Testament, is meant by the woman in Revelation 12:1. So the whole Babylon is the false, and the righteous woman in the New Testament in Revelation speaks of both Old Testament and New Testament people as well. Now remember, all murder from Cain down to the ones that are being committed right now somewhere are done because people are living in defiance of God and under Satan's sway. Now all such defiance will end forever. And that end will be over, and this world and this society will be finished, and the new one will begin. Next comes a section in Revelation 19, verses 1 to 5, comes thanksgiving for the judgment of Babylon. And my margins, my Bible says, heaven exalts over Babylon, of course, being destroyed. But we'll pick it up again when we continue in Revelation next month.